Sa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Tonight I'd like to begin my teaching by reading something that appeared in our local newspaper recently. And it has some interesting points of Dharma in it. It's entitled Collision. This is the transcript of a radio conversation between a US naval ship and Canadian authorities off the coast of Newfoundland. The radio conversation was released by the Chief of Naval Operations. The Americans: please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. Canadians: recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. Americans: this is the captain of a US Navy ship. I say again, divert your course. Canadians: no, I say again, you divert your course. Americans: this is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We were accompanied by three destroyers, three cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. That's 15 degrees to north, or countermeasures will be taken to ensure the safety of this ship. Canadians: this is a lighthouse. Your call. This is a very good illustration of some of the difficulties that we can encounter when we have wrong understandings. And this story particularly relates to the teaching the Buddha gave about the way the mind works, particularly around perception, thought, and view. And perception in the mind is that aspect of the mind that interprets the sense contacts that we have and makes sense of them. What we receive as hearing, what we receive as smelling, and all of the different senses. The mind has to interpret what it is that we've received, and it interprets that on the basis of previous experience and past knowledge. And very often the mind makes a guess at what this is. Not directly the object itself, but what it seems to be like based on previous experience with that kind of object. So in this story, the perception of the blip on the radar screen, or however it is these days with electronics, that information is received about what is in the environment. The perception of that, the interpretation of it by the American vessel, was that it was indicating a ship. That was the perception. And perception then gives rise to thought. This is the aspect of the mind, sankhara, which reacts to the kind of input that we've had. Once we've made a sense of what it is, an interpretation of what it is that we've come in contact with, then we think about, react to that thing. And in this case, because this blip was interpreted as a ship, the thought was, this is in our way. If we keep on this course, we're going to collide. That was one reaction. Then the next reaction was that this thing should get out of our way. Based on the view, this is the next aspect that feeds our reactions, our behaviours. How we interpret things and how we think about them is supported by our bigger, wider view of where that fits into our idea of the world, our place in the world, and the object's place in the world. So the view of the commander of the American ship was that this thing is in our way. We are bigger. There's more of us. We're more important. We take precedence. That was the view around which the reaction to this supposed ship came up. We're going to be colliding. They need to get out of our way. And so the next interaction, we recommend you divert your course to avoid a collision. And then the Canadian reaction, no, I recommend you divert your course. And then we see again the next perception on the part of the American commander. The perception which interpreted the refusal of the Canadians to move, or their suggestion that the Americans should divert their course, as not just being in the wrong place, but as being bad, as doing something provocative. There was a misunderstanding, a misinterpretation of the reaction, interpreted as defiant, because the initial perception was that this was a movable object, a ship. So the reaction, the reply, was interpreted as, we don't want to get out of your way. And so the next reaction from the Americans was, you'd better. Instead of now reacting to the object, the reaction is to the response that was given. And this is a very usual occurrence in all of our interactions. So now the reaction is not to the object itself, but to the response around that object, of that object. And the interpretation of the response is based on a wrong premise to start with, that this was a movable object rather than a lighthouse. And so we can see how the misunderstanding builds up. And then the reaction of the American commander, based on, again, their view, we really are the most important. Not only that, we're bigger and stronger than you are. We take precedence. Doesn't matter who you are or what you're doing there. You'd better get out of our way or else. The last reaction. We're accompanied by three destroyers, three cruisers. I demand that you change your course, or countermeasures will be taken to ensure the safety of this ship. My ship, I am the captain. My ship has to be safe. And I'm just using this particular story to illustrate this teaching on how our view of the world, our view of where we fit into it, our view of where others fit into it in relation to us, expresses itself in our thoughts and our perceptions. There's nothing unusual about that interchange. It's happening all the time in all of our lives. This is the way that our experience arises and is produced, is created. And if we can understand this, then we might be willing to start to ask ourselves, or to be a little bit skeptical about whether we've got it right at the level of perception. Is our interpretation accurate? At the level of thoughts that follow on from that perception, are these helpful, skillful? Are they going to lead to action which is profitable, going to get me what I want? And is my view of the world in keeping with reality? So the first part is just to understand these three aspects of how our experience is created. And the Buddha said that we all have wrong view. We all misinterpret the world and our place in it. And because of wrong view, our perceptions are inaccurate, they're biased, and the thoughts that flow on from those perceptions are very often also inaccurate and lead to our harm, lead to conflict. And even if it's not conflict with other people, it's conflict with the realities of life. The Buddha particularly pointed out four different ways in which we misinterpret our experience, or we turn a blind eye on our experience and allow wrong view to be the context in which we live our life. And these four aspects of wrong view, wrong perception, and wrong thought are that we live, we think about, we act towards that which is permanent, impermanent, as though it is permanent. We think and act towards things which are the cause of suffering as though they are the cause of happiness. We think and act towards things which are actually foul and impure as though they are beautiful. And we act and think towards things which are not really ours, not really self, as though they belong to me, as though they are me. These are the four ways in which wrong view expresses itself. And in order to change our wrong view and our inaccurate perceptions and the thoughts that flow from them, we have to tackle each of these aspects of our interpretation of experience in life. And we can start by trying to change our understanding, our view of things, and then that will help us to change our perceptions. Or we can work at changing our perceptions, and that will help to influence our view. It doesn't matter at which level, which aspect we start, because these things are circular. They fall back on each other. They support each other. So we have to have a way to get into this kind of practice. So tonight I'd like to particularly talk about developing these perceptions and these views in relation to the body. Because the Buddha has given very specific instructions, very specific meditations to do to help us to break through our delusion surrounding this body. We have this idea that this body is a source of happiness, that it's a source of pleasure, that it's a place where we find great joy. And that isn't completely wrong, because it does give pleasure. It allows us to eat delicious food, for example. It allows us to listen to lovely music. But that's only one small aspect of this body. This body gets sick. This body has aches and pains. From the moment we wake up in the morning, the first thought we have is, I've got to go to the toilet to relieve myself. If I can't, then I'll be uncomfortable. We have to wash it. We have to keep it clean. If we don't do that, it becomes very unpleasant for ourselves and others. This body is a constant source of suffering. We think that this body is beautiful because we only look at the surface. We only look at it in the way that gives rise to that perception. The Buddha said we need to look beyond the surface of the body. We need to look at all the different aspects of the body to see that what we take to be beautiful is really only skin deep. And even the skin isn't that beautiful if you get close up to it and see all the pimples and lumps, or the hairs coming out of the nose, or the sagging parts of the body once gravity starts to win. So this body isn't that beautiful. And we have this hope that we're going to be here forever, that this body is permanent. And we all know, really, at one level, that it's not. It's a temporary vehicle for this mind. And one day, the body isn't going to be able to sustain itself any longer, and it's going to fall apart. It's no longer going to be the vehicle for this mind. And so we have to be able to see through our hope that it isn't going to happen to me. And then this body we identify with as who I am. We identify with our gender. We identify with our skin colour. We identify even with the colour of our eyes, the colour of our hair. We identify with whether we're strong or weak, whether we're energetic or lacking in energy, lethargic. We identify with this body as me and as something that is mine, that I have control over. And when we start to reflect deeply on this body, we recognize that we have very little control over it. We can't decide when it's going to get sick. We can't decide when it's going to get old. We can't decide how it's going to function. We can't change the way that it naturally works. We can't decide that now we want our liver to do what our heart does because we'd like a bit of a change, something interesting. This body actually just functions according to its own nature, not according to our wishes and desires. So these are the sorts of ways that we need to start to challenge our wrong view about this body. And one of the meditations which the Buddha has given to us to start to do this is the meditation on the 32 parts of the body. This is a sort of classical meditation in Buddhism. And it's a meditation in which we start to learn what makes up this body, which I take to be me, which I take to be mine. The component parts that constitute this functioning organism. And the Buddha enumerated these, 32 of them. And what we do in this practice is we learn them, learn the names of them, and then we locate them within our anatomical structure. We reflect on the part they play in keeping this body going. And then we start to reflect on what that means for this body that I take to be me and mine. So I'm going to read out the 32 parts of the body. And just notice your reaction as you hear what we've all got inside this bag of skin. In this meditation, as you learn this meditation to do it, it starts off with, in this very body, from the soles of the feet up, from the crown of the head down, surrounded by skin, full of these various impurities, there are hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membranes, spleen, lungs, large gut, small gut, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, skin grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. In this very body, from the soles of the feet up, from the crown of the head down, surrounded by skin, full of these various impurities. Doesn't sound that nice when you hear all of those things. So the first part of this meditation is to familiarize ourselves with what this body actually consists of, and to understand that although we take this body to be a thing, it actually is made up of these various components, and it only functions when each of those components is doing its job. If any one of them breaks down, is injured, wears out, then all the other parts are going to be affected. So even, for example, if the tear duct blocks up and our eyes become dry and we get an infection, how miserable we can become from something that is so simple. So first of all, we start to identify the parts of the body, their location in the body, and the function that they play, to really bring home to us the fact that this is what this body consists of, this is what I consist of. The Buddha said that when we look inside, we see that this body is just like a sack, with a hole at the top and a hole at the bottom. And if you were looking into a sack that was full of different kinds of rice and lentils, you'd say, oh, there's some red rice and there's some white rice and there's some green lentils. you look at all the contents and see that that sack is full of all those different things with a hole at the bottom where they can pour out. And this body is just like that. It's made up of all these various parts, and only when the various parts work together can we say that this body is functioning. And the next aspect of looking at this body is to reflect on how do I feel about those component parts. They're in this bag of skin and we can't see them, thank goodness. Because if we had to look at our liver or our bowel or our heart, any of those things which are so precious, we wouldn't like it very much. We like them to be hidden away, out of the way, where they're not messy. When things come out of this body, it's messy, whether it's vomit or feces. So we need to reflect on this. This body is just acceptable because all those things are inside, not outside. And when we think, as we do this meditation and we go through the various parts, yes, we appreciate how good it is that they all work together, but we also realize how fragile the whole thing is, how susceptible to any kind of disturbance. And so our infatuation with this body as a source of happiness, as a thing of beauty, starts to be challenged. And then the next aspect of this meditation is to go beyond the concepts of liver and heart, blood, to reflect on the elements that make up this body. The Buddha described the whole of the material world as consisting of four different qualities of matter: the earth element, the air element, the fire element, and the water element. These are just descriptions of matter. And as we know from physics, matter is just energy. So these are different descriptions of the way that energy presents itself in this body and in the whole of this material world. So as we go further in this practice, we start to identify not the organs of the body, the component parts as we know them, but to identify those aspects of materiality that are predominantly reflecting the earth element. The earth element has the quality of being solid, of having hard or soft qualities of it about it. The fire element is the predominance of the quality of temperature in something. All matter, the Buddha said, is made up of different combinations of these four elements. The air element is that quality of materiality that has to do with movement, with friction, with expansion and contraction. And the water element, that is that quality of materiality and of energy that has fluidity, that is binding to the other elements. So, for example, this stand that this microphone is on is made of wood, and if I touch it, it's hard. It's predominantly the earth element. Hardness and softness are its predominant quality. But that is only relative, because this carpet is also hard. but relative to the wood, it's soft. So hardness and softness are relative concepts. And although this wood is predominantly hard, it also has the other elements in it. It has moisture in it. That's why the wood is held together. When the water element is dried up, then the wood will crack. This is bound together by the water element. Now, everything in the world is like that. And the Buddha said we need to be able to understand and experience that those elements inside our own body are just the same as the elements in the world around us. So in the body, we start to identify those parts of the body that are predominantly the earth element, like the bones. Predominant quality of that materiality is hardness. But the liver is also hard, although it's a bit squishy and soft. The earth element still predominates, but not to the same extent as with the bones. Now, why this is important is for us to be able to see that the elements that comprise our body are the same as the elements that comprise the rest of the world. There's nothing special in this body, and there's nothing in this body that is intrinsically mine, that I own, that is me. We have borrowed these elements from nature. And when we die, when this body is finished, then the elements will go back to nature. In order to be able to do any of these meditations, we need to give them time and repeated practice. First of all, we need to make the mind peaceful and calm, because this kind of meditation can only be done when the mind is already relatively peaceful. Otherwise, we can't remain focused on the parts of the body. We need then to progressively move from one stage to the next. First of all, just identifying this body in its component parts and asking ourselves as we move through, where am I in that? Which part of this body, which component part is me? Is it the hair of the head? What happens when I shave my hair? Where do I go? Is it the lungs? But what happens to me if I'm my lungs and my lungs don't work? What happens to me? As we then go through and see the true nature of this body, that it isn't this beautiful thing. How do I relate then to this body? And not only to my body, but to the bodies of others. We become very covetous about the bodies of others. People get entranced by the bodies of people they're attracted to. People break up marriages so that they can have that person, because they're just can't be without their beauty. People will kill because they have to have this person whose beauty is just so dazzling, delights them so much. This isn't unusual in the world. Now, if we were about to fall in love with someone who was married to someone else, and we remembered that the contents of their stomach were probably not as attractive as the hair on their head that we can see, then it might very easily help us to let go of our infatuation. And when we get angry with someone and we start to think about how terrible they are and what they said to us or what they did, and then we ask ourselves, well, really, which part of them am I angry at? Am I angry at their toenails? Am I angry at the blood that's flowing through them? And these are skillful ways to break down our reactions. And if we really understand how fragile this body is and how dependent it is on various causes and conditions just to keep it going, if we don't get the next breath, we could die. Not only I could die, this person that I'm about to have an argument with could die. This person that I think is so terrible or so wonderful, this person could die in the next breath. We start to gradually change our perceptions, our thoughts, and our views to bring them more in line with the way things really are, based on wisdom. So the point of this practice and this teaching is to allow us to let go of our attachments and our clinging. Because whatever delights us, wherever we think we're going to find happiness, we become attached to that thing, whether it's to our body or to the body of someone else. It may not be attachment in the form of sexual desire. It may be the attachment we have to the children in our family, or to our parents, or to our friends. We think we can't do without them. But if we realize that they too inhabit a body that is fragile, subject to causes and conditions, bound to change, sure to die, then we may perhaps not get so attached, not cling so much to that person that we think we can't live without. The Buddha said, once we're able to see things as they really are, we build a foundation for peace in our life. Peace that is based on wisdom, of knowing things as they really are, not based on wishful thinking. But in order to break through the delusion that we have to be willing to challenge our views and our perceptions. So our view that this body is actually a miracle, this body is wonderful, many of us have that view. So we don't like to hear anything said about this body, said against this body. Why do we have to always look on the negative side in Buddhism? Why can't we look at the positive? Why can't we be happy with this body? The point of it isn't to hate this body, but to see it as it really is. It may be a miracle that it's working right now, but in the next moment, that miracle can change into a catastrophe. Right now, there are people in the Buddhist society who have very grave illnesses. Who knows whether we're not going to succumb to an illness ourselves in this weekend? We're not going to get run over by a car. Who knows? That's how fragile this body is. So that's the point of doing this kind of practice, so that we can be prepared, that we're not going to be surprised, that we're going to be able to accept what it is that we have to deal with, to understand that this body is not I, is not mine, and is not a self. And sometimes when people hear this teaching, not only do they think, oh, it's too negative, they think that the purpose is to hate this body. And that is not the purpose either. We're trying to get a balanced view. And one of the nice teachings that was given to help us understand how we should relate to this body without hating it, but also without being infatuated with it, was one of the Buddha's enlightened disciples was asked by a king that he was teaching, well, if this body is so foul and really not me and mine. Why do you monks take so much time eating your dana and looking after this body if you think that this body is really foul and not worth much? And the reply that was given was, this body we treat with respect and care, just as we would look after a wound. If we have a wound on the body, we don't ignore it. We don't treat it harshly. We don't use that part of the body if it's injured. We look after the wound with care. We do what is necessary to make it heal. But we don't love the wound. We just do what needs to be done. And that's the attitude that we're trying to cultivate in our relationship with the body. To do what needs to be done, to appreciate it as the vehicle that we have in this life. It's the place where the mind abides during this birth. We need it. But we shouldn't go overboard and be infatuated with it. And if we're able to see this body as it really is, then we will be able to let go of a lot of suffering, of resisting reality, of resisting the facts of life. But in order to do that, we have to work on changing our perception. So next time you see someone you find very attractive, just have a look at the hairs coming out of their nose, and maybe you'll find the attractiveness dissipates. Next time you find yourself in a rage with someone and thinking about how terrible they are, look at some part of them and ask yourself, is that the part that I'm angry with? Their knobbly knees. So you can cut through this sense of this person being a solid thing. And as you gradually and repeatedly bring up this kind of perception in the mind, you will gradually undermine the wrong view that you have about this body. And as that wrong view is undermined, then you will find, as you particularly if you do this particular meditation repeatedly, that the next time you look at someone, you don't have to deliberately bring up that perception of something unpleasant. You will no longer be sucked in, no longer infatuated with the physical form that is in front of you. But this is a practice that needs to be repeated, and it needs to be done regularly, but it is a very useful one, and one that I recommend to you if you are particularly having trouble with lust in your life, particularly having trouble with infatuation in your life. This is the kind of practice which can help you to have a much more balanced and harmonious relationship to the people in your life. So that's the teaching for this evening, and may this help, the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. The question is about safeguards for this practice, because in the time of the Buddha, when the Buddha gave this teaching to the community of bhikkhus and then he went away on retreat, some of the bhikkhus practiced it to the extent that they started to hate this body and they felt that it was better to end their life, and they actually committed suicide. So obviously that isn't the intention of this practice. And this is a practice in a whole catalogue of meditation practices given by the Buddha. It is appropriate for people who have strong lust, but it isn't appropriate for people who have strong hatred, self-hatred, because it can cause further self-hatred. So one has to be wise in knowing whether this kind of meditation would be one that is appropriate. If you are particularly plagued by lust, this is a sort of meditation that you can start to take up. Or if you are particularly plagued with a sense of that you'll be able to control another person, or that you're ultimately in control of another person, then this kind of meditation can be very helpful, so that you see that actually I'm not even in control of my own body. So how could I hope to be in control of someone else? So the safeguards are that you should do this practice with wisdom. And if you have any doubts about it, if you find it particularly unattractive, then it's best not to take it up. It should always be balanced with loving kindness and with, as I said, an appreciation for this body, that this body is the vehicle that we have for this life. And so it's not that we want to harm the body, it's not that we want to ignore the body, but we want to have a balanced view towards it. Yes. No, the question is the perception that the body is a vehicle to be used towards nirvana, is that correct or incorrect? It's correct, and by reflecting on the body, this is one of the ways of developing wisdom, insight. We have to work with what we've got. Our experience of life is of this mind and this body. So it's not incorrect to see that the body is a very great support, and also that in this human birth, that the body is the basis for the mind and for the senses. So we obviously are working with that, and we need the body to do our practice and to even be alive to continue in this life. So the body is very important. But unfortunately, people see the body as an end in itself. And in this culture, we can see how much people identify with their body, with the beauty of their body, with the size of their body, with the length of their hair, with how they can decorate their body. And this idea that I am this body is very much reinforced in today's culture, and that whether I'm acceptable or unacceptable depends on this body. Whether I'm going to be happy or unhappy depends on this body. And so we're trying to get a more realistic attitude towards the body. Not to deny the importance of the body, but also not to give it a place that it doesn't warrant. And in the terms of practice, when we practice further, we come to the point where we recognize that the mind and the body are separate, and that our true happiness lies in the mind, not in the body. And as we go deeper in meditation, our sense of the body falls away completely, and we dwell just in the mind. And this is a very important aspect of the attainment of enlightenment, is not dependent on whether the body is male or female or healthy or sick or whatever. It's the state of the mind that is the crucial thing. Tonight's teaching was perhaps not so accessible for some people, but it is a very important part of practice, especially for those of you who have been practicing for some time and who are aware of the work that you need to do on attachment, or on particularly dealing with lust, and trying to incorporate this kind of meditation into your routine can bring great fruits. So although some of you might have found that the teaching was quite difficult tonight, I'm sure for some of you that it might be something that you'll be able to take up and use in your own practice. practice.